In 1892, two sisters, identical twins from Scotland, discovered one of the earliest known copies of the Gospels in a dark closet at a monastery on Mount Sinai. Janet Soskus's book, The Sisters of Sinai, tells the story of these two remarkable Victorian women who were not biblical scholars, but who made one of the most important scriptural discoveries of modern times. The book is published by Alfred A. Knopf, and I'm so glad it brings Janet Soskus here today. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you very much.
What got you interested in Agnes and Margaret Smith?
Well, I was interested in the Sinai story, and I'd gone to Sinai. And when I came back full of this to Cambridge in England, where I live, a number of people said, well, of course you know about Mrs. Gibson and Mrs. Lewis. And I didn't. So I began to read about them because they had ended their days there and they had founded the Presbyterian College in Cambridge. And I became enchanted.
Tell us about the manuscript they discovered in St. Catherine's Monastery on Mount Sinai.
Well, the first thing to say, perhaps, is that the monastery, which is this very remote and ancient monastery, had become quite famous in the 19th century because in the 1840s, a German scholar called von Tischendorf discovered the most ancient Bible in the world, the Codex Sinaiticus, there. And this was a very important discovery. And most people reckoned that he had found everything worth finding. But my two twin sisters, who only went out when both were bereaved, they really went as a sort of consolation. They went into the desert, and they were nearly 50 years old. One had read something that said there might be manuscripts in Syriac that hadn't been examined.
And Syriac is an ancient
Syriac is the language. It's basically Aramaic. It's basically the language spoken by Jesus and his disciples. And, of course, these two ladies, being devout Presbyterians, thought, oh, you know, something really ancient in Syriac. Maybe it's the first draft of Mark's Gospel or something. I don't know exactly what they thought, but they were terribly excited by this idea. So in the 9 months between her husband's death and going out, this one twin, Agnes, learned Syriac, which she said wasn't so difficult if you knew Hebrew and Arabic, which she did. And they went out, and of course, many people said they wouldn't even be admitted to the monastery, being women. But they went out. They had to go to Cairo and hire a guide, who had to hire camels and Bedouin drivers 10 days across the desert. And when they got there, they were admitted. I should also say that they spoke modern Greek, which was the language of the monks. And the monks asked them what they wanted to see. And they were shown to this dark closet, this dark underneath the abbot's lodgings. And there came out this dark, forbidding-looking thing.
You describe it as a dark woj of a book.
Yes, that's right. And it turned out, well, they brought it up to the light of day. And what it was a palimpsest, which is vellum being so valuable, the monks used to recycle it. So when a manuscript became battered, they would scrape off the writing with a knife and then re-inscribe another text on top. So the upper writing of this was Lives of Women Saints, dated about 773. But Agnes could see peeping through this underwriting at the top, according to Matthew, according to Luke. So she figured it was a palimpsest. She figured it was the Gospels, and she figured it must be pretty early to be recycled in this way. And she was right. This was the beginning of their great adventure, but not the end of their struggles.
No, absolutely not. Now, they didn't take it back with them to England. They took photographs.
That's right. There was a lot of thieving from monasteries, it must be said, or academic thieving. No, they didn't. They took photographs. In fact, one of the academics who had encouraged them, a Quaker scholar called Rendell Harris, had said they must take a camera, and he equipped them, and they'd only taken two successful photographs before they left from Cambridge for Sinai. They took 1,000 negatives, and at Sinai they took 400 photographs of this palimpsest, of course not having any idea how they could come out. Imagine taking a photograph of a palimpsest, and went back to Cambridge with those.
And you reproduce one of the pictures in the book, where you can see, I think it was a monk who was helping them,
yes,
his thumb,
yes,
holding it up. And it just looks like a brick. And you described that the pages had dirt in between them. And when they tried to pry them apart, they would crumble.
Well,
did they preserve any of this?
Well, exactly. I mean, in fact, they used their camp kettle to steam the pages apart, which isn't advised. If you find an ancient manuscript, don't do this. But that they weren't, I suppose, so interested in preservation in those days. But they did when they came back with a group of transcribers. They had quite a lot of difficulty, I must say, because when they took these photographs, dash back to Cambridge, which took about 6 weeks to dash from Sinai, 10 days across the desert and so on, and got there at the beginning of the summer holidays, and the academics were going. But the two greatest scholars of Sirach in the town wouldn't look at their photographs. Agnes said, Mr. Burkett wouldn't look at them even when I tried to show him in his own garden. So I think there was a little bit of just a couple of middle-aged, just Scottish, just widows, just, you know, they're not scholars. They think they've found something. When they finally, by almost trickery, persuaded the scholars to take some interest, then the scholars immediately realized it was important, swore them to secrecy, and then they went back, the scholarly team, which included Agnes and Margaret, to transcribe this. And there they did take some more care with preservation issues.
Why the secrecy? What was going on with biblical scholarship at the time that would create such anxiety over this discovery?
Well, it's very hot. You've got to remember that they were Scottish Presbyterians, and most English-speaking Christians just had accepted the Bible, you know, in the King James Version as the Word of God. And it came as a big shock to a lot of people to realize in the 19th century that the oldest physical manuscripts of the Bible that we could lay our hands on easily were probably only about 1,000 years old. I mean, many people, if you'd thought about it, you must realize that before printing, all copies of the Bible had to be transcribed by hand, and there could have been errors creeping in. So there was a real excitement about finding old Bibles, especially after Tischendorf had found the Codex Sinaiticus, and finding not just Bibles, but other kinds of early Christian documents. They're piecing together the history of early Christianity. So this was all very heady stuff for people at that time. And you might say there were, of course, the familiar waves of anxiety associated with Darwinism was right. already affecting things. And there was a greater age of doubt. So the whole question, some people, well, as early as Thomas Paine earlier, had been saying, oh, well, the Bible was written decades, maybe hundreds of years after the events it's meant to chronicle. And so there's a great push to get back there, both for people who wanted to show it was the New Testament, say, as we know it was very early, and for those who wanted to say it wasn't, to go back and try to find these things. And it turned out these great Eastern monasteries were the places where the oldest Bibles were to be found.
I'm Amy Edding, sitting in for Leonard Lopate, and I'm speaking with Janet Soskiss. She's the author of The Sisters of Sinai, How Two Lady Adventurers Discovered the Hidden Gospels. It's published by Knopf. What was in the palimpsest? Did it change anything about biblical scholarship?
It was a very important find at the time. It was
besides its age, I mean, it was certainly the, and it still is. It remains the oldest.
It remains the oldest copy in Syriac. Physically, it dated from the late 4th century, which put it just a bit later than the Codex Sinaiticus, which is Greek, the oldest Greek complete Gospels. The scholars could tell from the language that was used that the translation it bore, rather than the physical manuscript itself, was probably late 2nd century. And this pushed the Gospels, the fact that they were the four Gospels together, back very, very early. The other thing that it was quite definitive for is Mark's Gospel ended with the women at the tomb of Jesus, and it's empty. There were no resurrection appearances. And this had been the case with other ancient manuscripts people had found, but no one knew with those other ones whether bits had just fallen off. But this was decisive. It had ended at the earlier stage. And then there were a couple of other smaller things. But it was, I think, just one more step in pushing back the dating of the New Testament particularly. And, of course, scholars in the next generation went on to find very, very early fragments. For instance, John's Gospel, which many scholars in the beginning of the 19th century, because it's so Greek in many ways, people thought that must have been dated much later, maybe a couple of centuries after Jesus. Well, the oldest physical fragments of the New Testament we have are John's Gospel from about, you know, 120. Mm. So very much earlier than anyone had thought.
You mentioned the twins' Presbyterian faith. Mm-hmm. For those who don't know Presbyterianism, what was that like at that time? How did that mean that they were about their faith?
Well, and of course it could be kind of a very austere, Sabbatarian kind of faith, quite rule governed. There are lots of horrible stories of Scottish childhoods with this very austere...
No dancing.
And no dancing, no singing even of hymns and so on. But in their case, they had a very strong view in Providence. For instance, that was a great thing for their travelling maxim, God knows the hour of your death. And for this, they meant if you're going to die, you know, on a boat at sea, you will. And if you're not, you're not. So they just simply weren't afraid of travel. And it was good for them. It also, that I think, and I'm not Presbyterian, but I have a great admiration for this tradition, everyone's life is valuable, and you shouldn't just fritter it away. You have a responsibility, whether you're a noble knight or a washerwoman. You have a responsibility for your life, and you should do something. And there's something, there's some vocation for you to follow. And I think a lot of their stories is, as it were, looking around, what is it we're to do? Because the vocation held out for Presbyterian women at this time was marriage and a family. Or if you didn't do that, you should look after your brother or your uncle or your dad or your aunt. They had their mother died giving birth to them. Their father was their only relation as far as they knew. And when he died, that was it. So here they are. He left them very wealthy, lots of money. But what should they do with their lives? And they couldn't just do what many women in their position would have done, wealthy, just go from party to party. And so they diverted themselves into languages and study.
Now, why didn't they behave like that? What was it about their upbringing that made them shun the more typical Victorian women's life?
I think it's because they were brought up by their father. He obviously had servants in a small town. And there's clearly very little kind of frippery. He was a self-made man, a lawyer who benefited from the Scottish educational system and come from a modest background. And he didn't believe in a lot of posturing. And he brought them up, educated them more or less as though they were boys. So they had an unusually high degree of education for girls in those days. And I think that they obviously didn't care much about fashion. In later life, they did. They bought their dresses in Paris on the way to...
And hiked up Mount Sinai
in their
big, heavy skirts.
Yes, they did. And of course, if you're traveling in these, you were a woman, you had to take these things, because if you're staying in your hotel in Suez, you were expected to dress for dinner with gloves and everything, and you then had to carry that gear all through the Sinai. But I digress. But I think it was this feeling that you should do something with your life, the fact that they'd been brought up, educated as boys, and that they'd been sort of rather taught to think it was a bit trivial to just spend your time talking about, isn't that a nice tea set or something like that.
Agnes and Margaret traveled to Cairo, they traveled to Sinai, they traveled to Jerusalem, and they did it alone, without male chaperones. Now, how did they pull this off in this part of the world?
Well, the interesting thing is their first trip, because what happened when their father died rather unexpectedly, and they were 23, and they were living in this very small Scottish village, they clearly decided to go down the Nile. They must have planned this trip while they were deep in mourning. And there were guidebooks. They must have ordered a guidebook, Murray's guidebook to Egypt.
To the Nile.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. And it told you things like what kind of claret and what kind of Rhine wine to drink on the Nile, and that you should have a small pistol for firing as a dinner gong to neighbors you've invited from neighboring boats when you're having a dinner party. So it was painted a splendid picture of conviviality and sort of a upper echelon elegance for them. And I think they planned this trip. And their father, clearly, they'd traveled a lot with their father. And this was unusual because most British people, even of means, didn't travel. And he had clearly, the normal way that people would travel would be to have a courier with them who is a kind of portable travel agent who spoke the languages, made the bookings, etc., and went with you. But their father clearly disdained that, and so did they for this first Nile trip, because they spoke the languages. But they couldn't go entirely unchaperoned. They were only 23, so they asked a former schoolmistress. She was only 36 herself, and she went with them. So these three women went all across Europe to Budapest, down the Danube, Constantinople, and over to the Nile.
You were an atheist but had a conversion experience in the shower.
Yes.
Did that happen before you started studying philosophical theology?
Oh, yes, indeed. Yes, it did. Yeah, no. That was, yes.
And what is philosophical theology?
Well, it could be philosophy of religion. So the kinds of things that I teach would be faith and religion, faith and reason, science and religion, religious language and symbolism. I've worked a lot in that. Some in gender and religion. So these kind of areas, they're the kind of the underpinnings of religious belief and symbolism.
You wrote Sisters of the Sinai with a wry, lighthearted voice. How did you find that tone?
Well, that's interesting because it was broadcast in five series on the BBC, a British Broadcasting Company, this spring, and they had a Scottish actress reading it. And when I heard that, I suddenly realized that her voice was wrong and that the voice I had in mind was that of my first landlady when I was a graduate student, and she was a Glaswegian lady. And she had this kind of brisk wit, you know, no nonsense. Well, you know, he was the sort of person, a lovely husband, that then he died, you know, very abrupt and no nonsense, no feeling sorry for yourself. And I realized I had that. I also have a Glaswegian aunt, and she's very like this. And I must have, without ever thinking about it, had these ladies in my mind. As there is a kind of, I won't say a prototype Glaswegian lady, but there's a sort of Scottish lady that I had in mind, I think, without almost knowing it.
And the twins' own writings are very wry themselves, I find.
Well, they are, and sometimes you don't know whether it's intentional or not. I mean, one of them, Agnes, wrote a memoir of her brother-in-law when he died, and he died. He had been he had worried all his life about his health and about dying, and in fact put off.
Oh, I'm sorry, Janet.
That's all right.
Table this for another time. No. Janet Soskis, The Sisters of Sinai, How Two Lady Adventurers Discovered the Hidden Gospels, published by Knopf. Thanks so much for joining me this afternoon.
My pleasure. Thank you.
This is the WNYC, WNYC.org.